Oh, I've already messed it up. Yikes. It's a good job only Andrew Wilson is listening so far. This is episode 4 of We Can't Promise Anything. Advice with Marion and a little bit from me, Gilly, as well. Can't believe we're on episode 4 already. We tried to get through a lot today. Marion keeps on putting additional demands into the production conditions, which is very difficult. She's a very difficult collaborator. It's a real challenge to work with Marion. Okay, I'm waffling now, but there is something I want to say. So later on in the show, we talk about something which is about, we talk about a couple of problems that people sent in that are about weight and gaining weight and losing weight and whether that's okay. And I have lots of really strong opinions about this, as you will hear. But I say something in a way that I'm now not comfortable with how I phrased it. So just in case that's a problem, I wanted to just clarify what I meant. So what I mean is that because our preferences about lots of things are highly conditioned, I think we should be critical of them. Because they can cause grave, grave harm. And I give an example that's a bit strange, and I sort of wish I'd said it in another way, but hopefully that's comprehensible. Let us begin with another jingle from Jack Burton, who supplied us with a different jingle every week, and then on to the show. Right then, Marion, what did you think of that one?
I loved it. I love all of our jingles, Gilly. And in fact, I think I might like that one the best, but then your memory's not hugely reliable. But
when we get to the end, we'll just cycle back to the beginning.
Yes, I think we need to have a little bit of a refresh at some point. But I think if everybody just had a little dance to our jingles, we'd automatically feel better.
Oh, that's true. I mean, I was dancing away.
I wasn't.
No, you weren't. You were just laughing at me.
I was, you're right.
I was doing it to entertain you. Right, so this is episode 4 of We Can't Promise Anything, Advice with Marion and Gilly. And it's called We Can't Promise Anything because we're extremely amateur agony aunts.
Yes, because the title reflects the truth of what we do. We absolutely can't promise anything. And we are amateur, and it's we just like to chat about, you know, life, the universe,
and other people's problems.
Yes, but that's because we've had a lot of practice talking about our own Gilly.
Well, we've just spent 40 minutes talking about some of my problems.
Yes, and some of mine too.
That's true.
Yeah. And, you know, putting chatting about problems kind of makes them easier to you can.
It does.
Clears the air a little bit and you can see better where you're going, where you're headed, I think.
Sometimes it stokes the rage, but that's part of it.
Well, then just dance to one of our jingles and it'll release it all.
That's true. Right, we've got some feedback from previous weeks. So firstly, do you remember the woman who wrote in and said, oh, well, now I can choose to extend my social bubble. I'm a person who lives alone. And I can choose either my sister who's pregnant and has a small child at home, or my new boyfriend, who I only met a couple of times pre-lockdown, and we've kept in touch and you know, stayed in communication over the past 3 months. And we had differing views.
Yes, we did, because I thought she should go and see her sister, because you can always get another boyfriend, but you can't get another sister.
And I thought that she should go with a boyfriend, because the sister would be fine without her. But I don't have a sister, so... And what she said is she really appreciated the conversation. And also she did feel that thing of like, oh yes, that's what a sisterly bond is, an important one. But she did choose the boyfriend.
Right. Well, I hope it was worthwhile, Gilly.
Well, what she said was that she thinks it was the right thing to do because Lily had taught her that it's probably not going to be a lasting relationship.
Oh, dear.
Which I do think is good, because imagine if she'd chosen the sister and then had to wait a few more weeks and put a few more weeks of emotional investment into it without really realising, like, oh, actually, there's a few things here that are not right for me. So I don't think her sister's too annoyed. I think it's okay.
Well, as long as the sister bond is still has sustained the little attack on it, then that's fine.
The little attack on it, wow. Yeah. So we have got some more feedback, and this is from Sophie, who wrote in about a Raji dog, Wilma. And she says, I'll read this out because this is a written one. She said, I've just listened to the last We Can't Promise Anything. I'm genuinely crying with laughter. Your point is so true. If they can't handle Wilma, they can bugger off. Charming Rajiness. Also, Princess Coconut, that was the dog I mentioned. I realised Princess Coconut is the canine companion of Ed, who does one of the Star and Shadow jingles. And Sophie also says, I'm loving the show so much. What a joy. I wish it was on every morning. Sophie, it's so tense just doing this.
Yes, it is.
I don't think we can do every morning.
I don't think we can go with anymore.
But also, we don't have enough problems. Like, I really had to, like, scour for problems. I really had to, like, beg people I know for problems.
Yes, but now, Gilly, we've got lots of we've even got problems for next time.
Yeah, but although, I still want people, if they've got even a little...
Yes.
I'd want people to send in their problems, if they can.
Yes.
They want to.
Or even advice to problems that we do, because we do like advice too, because we could miss something, which would be unusual, but you never know.
Did we really do cover a lot? But what I also enjoy is people telling me that we're good. Like, I like that. So thank you very much.
I thought a little bit unbelievable, because I think this is a terrifying roller coaster terror ride experience to do. But any lovely feedback is very gratefully received by both of us, I think.
But especially from Sophie, because she is a beloved Star and Shadow broadcaster herself. She does the Sleepy Time show.
Well, do you know, you told me that Sophie did Sleepy Time show, so I thought I would listen to it. Which I did last Sunday, but I thought it was on at 8 o'clock, and it wasn't. It wasn't until 9 o'clock. So I listened to this really lovely brass music show first, which I loved, and then I listened to Sophie's show, which the music was fantastic. And do you know, I'm just discovering the joys of Star and Shadow Radio. I didn't realise it was so fabulous.
Well, pass it on. And also,
I do pass it on, yes.
Also, Star and Shadow is obviously a volunteer-run venue, and some of how it continues to run is because people come and they normally buy tickets or they buy drinks. And obviously that can't happen right now. So Star and Shadow are continuing to try and raise money through donations. So if you're listening and think, oh yeah, I would have bought a pint from the Star and Shadow. I would have gone to the cinema at the Star and Shadow, and I'm enjoying the radio. You could always pop a bit of cash through the website.
I think that's a really good idea. And I do think Star and Shadow Radio brings lovely entertainment to anybody who tunes in, far more than some of the bigger radio stations.
That's true. Particularly us, eh?
Oh, well, you know. But we're so modest, we wouldn't actually say. We'll leave that for the audience to say, Gilly.
Oh, yes, and do say. We do like that.
Yes, we do, indeed.
Right, Marion, I'm going to lead us into the first problem of the day. So this comes from Hannah, and she says, hey, Gilly and Marion, here is my problem. I am a freelance dancer and choreographer, and the hourly paid short-term contract I had teaching at a university has come to an end. My mum died very suddenly in February, and I became my dad's main support / carer as my twin lives in the US. Obviously, working in the arts right now is not even factoring into my thinking. LOL/crying face. I need a job that is flexible and ideally part-time due to my caring responsibilities. My dad has emphysema, so I'm a little bit nervous about getting a public-facing job, and all the jobs I would normally get when dance work was then on the ground are public-facing or don't exist or already staffed, like cafe work, shop work, working in a yoga studio. I have no idea where to start looking for a job, what I could do, and what my transferable skills are. Help!
Goodness, giddy. Do you know?
I feel for you, Hannah.
Me too. Hannah has had a very tough year.
Yeah.
And it's very sorry at all everything that's happened in her life. And, you know, good for her for getting in touch and wanting to kind of put it out there a little bit of what she can do. But, you know, it must be really hard.
Yeah.
And good for her for what to want to put some sort of to get something sorted.
Yeah,
put some sort of structure on the life that she has now.
I mean, what I think is really good, like I also work, so I work with Hannah sometimes, and I also work in dance land and in higher education, and it is, and my contract is also coming to an end, and it is a different kind of terrifying than I've experienced before, when you're looking at the two industries that you're trained to work in and you're witnessing their crumbling.
Yeah.
And, you know, where people like Hannah and I are in the pecking order, we have such little capacity to change anything. It's like minuscule. So you also feel like kind of, you know, not part of it somehow, that like, you know, it's other people's decisions that are going to determine my fate. And that's terrifying. But what I really like about Hannah's question is that she's not so tied to this idea of like, for me to feel okay about myself, I have to only work in dance, or I have to only work in the arts, or I have to only work in teaching. She's like, I just need to do something. And I think, although that's really difficult, and of course, it's annoying to spend time doing things that you maybe don't enjoy or don't feel like close to, I also think that there's a liberty in that, because you can go, you can do your work, you can get your money, and then you can leave. And that's different to, you know, teaching in university. Until you leave, you're consumed by it. Maybe not everyone feels like that, but I feel like that. Or working in the arts, you know, it's very difficult to put it down. You don't believe it. And I really like that Hannah is so open to, actually, I might need to make other kinds of decisions, and that's just fine. That's just fine.
Yeah, because I just need to accept that everything's changed out of all recognition in every direction. I think she has, what do you think about her looking at it like from a making a plan point of view, of lots of, with different kind of aspects to it, like there's the practicalities of being a carer. First of all, are you getting all of the benefits that you're entitled to?
Yeah.
Are you getting all of the care packages? There's lots of organizations out there who can give you advice. Sometimes there's benefits that you didn't even know existed. Yeah. And you can ring organisations like Age UK, and I only say Age UK because I had a friend who worked for them, but there's lots of organisations out there. So are you getting all of the benefits and care packages that you can? Because I don't think you should say no to any help that's available, because you want to focus on quality time with your dad, and also be free to maybe get a little bit of work organized for yourself.
There might be carers allowance or something like that. I don't know much about it, but
yes. So it's I'm just saying, are you claiming and receiving everything that you're entitled to? Because that could ease a little bit of pressure. And then the next thing is what can you, then you can decide how much money you maybe need to earn, and have a look. I don't know how poorly Hannah's dad is. Does she need to be around quite a bit during the day, or Has she got long periods of time available, or has she only got small snippets of time that she can go out and earn some money? Or if you Google, what can I do working from home, and loads of things come up, or, you know, even simple things like put an advert in the post office window to say you'll walk dogs, or or do garden tidy ups, or, you know.
The things I thought about were like, so Hannah, if you work in HE or you work in the arts and you get, you know, you often then in one way or another, you have to become a very good administrator. You have to be super efficient. The volume of work is very high. If you're running your own projects, you have to be like financially literate. You have to be able to essentially run your own business.
Yes, you do. And if you apply for grants and things, you're very good at doing applications.
So I wonder if there's like home-based admin jobs.
A friend of mine, her daughter, runs like a virtual assistant thing where they provide admin support remotely to small companies.
That might be a good route. But I have also, this might not be ideal, but I have also heard that there are call centres who need people to be able to work from home now. And they're really in need. Mm-hmm. And I've worked in a call centre and it is rubbish. It is boring.
But then sometimes you've just got to flick that switch off, haven't you? And say it's a means to an end rather than it's what I need to do for a period of time. It's not the rest of my life.
I've also seen that Royal Mail are recruiting.
Oh, interesting.
It's quite a high contact job though. So if you're trying to shield, that might be very tricky.
Yeah, well, the third thing I was going to say was Hannah also needs to look after herself and keep her own social. So our own social network, support network. She needs to have a network and kind of use it and keep in touch with all her friends. So, because it's hard work being a carer and having to earn money, so you've got to look after you. She's got to look after herself as well. So I don't know if, you know, like call centre work might feel a little bit trapped that she's in the house all the time, but then we are in lockdown, you know?
Yeah, it's like, this isn't good, you know, in these contexts, we're not going to find an ideal, but is there a scenario that you can live with?
Yes. But only Hannah can decide what
that scenario is. Yeah. And also, a lot of this kind of work, it's quite low commitment. So if after a week you're like, absolutely not, I can't do this, you can hand in your notice and be done with it. Doesn't mean you're going to find another job straight away, but you can get out. It's not like a job where you sign up and you've got to give a 2-month notice.
Yeah. I also know what it feels like to not be doing the job that you're passionate about. And feel like you're making do with something that's really a bit excruciating, and it feels like it's forever, but it's not actually. And even the most boring, mindless jobs, I think you still learn something about yourself, and it can be quite a positive experience, even if it's just, I never want to do another job like that as long as I live. It's not of no value. You learn about
yourself. You sort of have to put it on your bucket list in order to take it off.
Yes, you do. Yeah.
I want to do a rubbish, boring job.
I think broadening that out, you can get a lot of respect for people who actually do it on a daily basis.
Definitely.
You know, so there's lots of things you can learn about yourself. And about the world.
Oh, I hope that helps, Hannah. Let us know. Let us know what you think, what you come up with. I'd be very interested.
I don't know how creative Hannah is. I mean, you can open a little online shop, or if you can make things, or...
I think that's a dead end, because you just... Yeah. The profit margins are so slight that I think that's just dead hard. I think it's really hard. That has to be a passion project rather than a moneymaker, I think.
Right, okay.
That's just me, though. I also think then you'll probably lose the joy in making things quite quickly.
Yes, because it would turn into a chore.
Well, exactly. I find that with lots of things anyway. Things I love doing. Suddenly they become a job and I'm like, oh, this seems really difficult and awful. Don't like it at all. Hey, I really do hope that's all right for you, Hannah. Do get in touch. We can't promise anything at gmail.com. Or, you know, I know you, Hannah. So you can contact me. you can give me a ring. Shall we move on to the next problem, eh?
Yes, let's. So this one, Gilly, is we've had two problems from two different people, but they're kind of related.
Yeah.
Yeah. So would you like to do yours first?
Oh, I can, yes. So the one I'm going to read out is, okay, during lockdown, I found myself being much less active than I would have normally been and unable to reduce a growing comfort diet. Unsurprisingly, there I have experienced noticeable weight gain with clothes not fitting and mild body shame. To combat this, I've decided to cull my diet of excessive carbs and sugars. After 4 weeks, I feel better, lighter, with noticeable gains. But after speaking to a good friend about this, I'm now concerned about cultivating an eating disorder or if worrying too much about capitalist ideas regarding body image, etc. Currently, I'm okay, but I worry about what the long-term implications might be. That was one of them. You want to read yours out?
I will. Dear Gilly and Marion, please help. I've put on a lot of weight during lockdown, so much so I'm avoiding weighing myself. I've cooked lots of tasty food, baked many delicious cakes, and I've loved sitting outside in the evening with a bottle of wine. Now that restrictions are easing, I'm feeling really unhappy because lots of my unstretchy clothes don't fit anymore, and I really don't like how I feel or look about this. How can I take myself in hand?
I have lots of opinions about this.
Oh, do you?
Right. I do. So, yeah. So, well, I think one really important thing to remember is that we're in a global crisis. Yeah. So, like,
yeah.
So we're experiencing a lot of stress. The circumstances are completely unknown to us. We don't know what's going on. There might be, as Hannah was describing, there might be sort of financial or work-related stress. There might be, you know, you might be like trapped in a house with someone who you don't want to spend so much time with, or you might be unable to see the people you do want to see, and so on. So that's very stressful, right? So the idea of comfort eating, if you think about, like, food is not just fuel. Food is all kinds of things. It's social, it's sensory pleasure, it's tradition and ritual, it's all kinds of things, food. So, but if you think about, like, we're in this context, yeah, where everything's really hard and we need coping mechanisms. We do, that's just like, people say coping mechanisms as if that's a terrible thing. Coping mechanisms are good. They're good ways to release that stress and help us move on with things. So my view, very much informed by Isabel Fox and Duke, who's a writer and thinker on issues of mostly around intuitive eating, especially women's eating, body shame, anti-fat phobia, anti-fatness. And what she says is, like, eating is actually a very benign coping mechanism. So we think of all the coping mechanisms that a human being might have. They might drink loads and loads of booze or take drugs or act out with aggression or damage things or damage a relationship or be awful to someone. Having a few donuts, whilst probably it's not going to solve your problems, it might temporarily tide you over to feel better. It's fine as a coping mechanism. So I think, like, we need to, like, sort of put down this idea of comfort food as a bad thing. Food is a fine place to achieve comfort. That's one thing. That's one opinion.
Right. So I'm going to counter that. I completely understand that and accept that. But regardless of what Isabel says, if it's making you unhappy, then it's making you unhappy. So maybe you need to look for an additional coping mechanism to take a little bit of the pressure off comfort food, because comfort food can start to snowball out of control a little bit.
Well, Isabel Fox and Duke also does talk about when emotional eating then becomes binge eating. And the trigger for that, for it to change, is the idea of restriction. So when you either mentally or physically restrict, you believe yourself to be in a sense of starvation and you respond, you react to that by overeating, by eating even when you don't want to. So if you think, there's been lots of studies, there's the Minnesota
Well, there's nothing worse than being, you can't do something.
Well, exactly. But also, if you think about food, that's also a natural survival instinct. If you told me there's going to be no food, tomorrow I'm going to be on a diet, there's going to be no food. Or even, I really shouldn't eat that. Something in you is going, you're not going to have food. And food, you know, we need food. So there's this really famous experiment called the Minnesota Starvation Experiment, where they on purpose put a load of men on a calorie restricted diet. And that had the consequence of causing some of these people lifelong problems with eating and not eating. Lifelong problems. And they all, in the end, put on weight, excess weight, weight that they didn't want to have, and weight that they didn't start with. So,
and additionally, Gilly, lots of people live their lives yo-yo dieting.
Which is very dangerous for you. It's much more dangerous metabolically than being at a higher weight. So we have this idea that a BMI is it like a good thing to think about. The BMI, the body mass index, was never designed to deal with individual weights. It was designed to deal with populations, to understand population weight. And in fact, people who have, obviously I do a lot of reading about this. So people have...
You'd never know.
So people who are in the BMI category overweight live longer than people who are in the BMI category normal. So these BMI categories are actually quite arbitrary. And at some point in the late 20th century, they just moved. It was to make the maths easier. It wasn't because suddenly these people were unhealthy and these people were healthy.
Yeah.
Got nothing. BMI and health are not connected to one another. They're not. So that means that you can just pop that right in the bin. That doesn't make any sense. And although I think you're right, there's something about coping mechanisms that's going on for me. Like I have a history of eating disorders, all kinds of eating disorders in all different directions. I've been trying to just eat whatever I want to eat, to try and build a trust in my body that you would have as a child, that because of the experiences in my life were sort of knocked out of me. As it is for particularly a lot of women, because we're told to be smaller, so then you lose trust in your sense of hunger and fullness. So then you don't have a sense of trust in your body, so then you overeat and you put on weight, and then you start to freak out about putting on weight, because to be fat is the worst thing you can be in our society. And
then it's a cycle that you get trapped in.
And then you get heart disease and you think that's because you've been fat, but it's not. It's because you've been weight cycling, also known as yo-yo dieting, or the consequences of yo-yo dieting. But I've noticed lately that if there's a work task that I don't want to do or feel annoyed about or feel stressed about, I'll just snarfle a whole load of sugar. And I don't actually feel better. Like, so it's the coping mechanism is kind of tipped off the edge, and I end up feeling sick, a bit sort of headachy from the sugar. And actually I think what's happened is in lockdown, some of my other coping mechanisms have lost their strength. So I haven't been meditating in the way I might do. I don't have the social contact that I normally do. I don't have other ways to deal with myself. So it's gone to sugar. So what I'm gonna do is just deal with that a little bit for now. But I have to be really clear to myself that I know to be fat is not worse than to be thin. To be fat is fine.
Yeah. But if you feel unhappy about putting weight on...
I think we need to be much more critical about why we feel happy or like something. I really do. Because otherwise, we end up in a situation where, oh, I just prefer hanging out with white people. It's just my personal preference. I just prefer it. And that what that is called is racism. So we can have personal preference, but actually those personal preferences are wildly conditioned by the circumstances in which we find ourselves. So I don't shave my armpits, for instance. And a lot of women will say, oh, I just prefer it. And I'm like, how do you know you prefer it? When every single image of a woman that you're told is attractive has no hair in her armpits. How do you know you prefer it? You don't. It's not a balanced view in the world. You don't have a range of options. So I don't trust myself to know what I prefer. So then I prefer just to do nothing. And I also think that's really present in weight culture, in body image culture, because we don't see a range of bodies. There might be more of a range now, but every single one of them's got a flat stomach. That's for sure. Flat belly, flat abdomen, no fat on the abdomen. You can have a big bum.
But not if you go outside and look at people. That's only images that are presented to you either on some sort of media. If you actually go outside and look at people, there is every single body shape you can possibly imagine.
Of course. But if we're told over and over again, that's an attractive body, that's an unattractive body, over and over and over and over and over again, we internalize those values. And the reason that those values are so important is because it makes us buy stuff. So if...
Well, yes, we live in a consumer world. So it's all about spending money.
But yes. That's why I think we need to be really critical of how we arrive at our sense of preference.
I agree with everything you've said, Gilly. I also think, at my perspective, an additional perspective, is that pre-lockdown, we're all in a routine, a working routine, whatever, but we're all in a routine, and you looked the way you looked, you lived the way you looked because of the life that you had. And now we're in lockdown, and lots of people's lives have changed beyond all description, beyond description. And to settle into it, it's the human condition to like the same thing, to like a routine. And to be thrown out of your routine can upset everything about your perception of yourself. And you can move into eating as a comfort or as whatever to fill the time in, whatever reason, because life as you knew it, that kept you, that where you felt more content with yourself, has gone for how long? No, nobody knows. So it's really, if you haven't established a routine that you feel happy with, look at it and ask yourself, why are you eating more? Or it's about being honest, and maybe everything you say is right, but it doesn't mean that you have to be passive about accepting a situation.
But I think strengthening other coping mechanisms rather than punishing yourself
for relying
on something that really works.
Absolutely, how I would put it, strengthen other coping mechanisms rather than punishing yourself, because punishing yourself is a spiral to more.
And the science does show that, depending on which study you look at, something between 90 to 98% of intentional weight loss diets do not work after 4 years, and you will be bigger. I don't think fatter is worse, but you will be fatter.
Yeah.
So consider that very carefully before you launch yourself into something that...
So, you know, one of our letters said that they've cut out carbs.
Yeah.
They've cut... Well, excessive carbs, not completely, and sugars. And as long as you're just cutting out excessive, that's all right, but you need a balanced diet. Nobody should cut food groups out of the diet.
Absolutely not. But also, we need to question what a sense of excess is.
Yes.
I think with the things that I've read and paid attention to, I'm keen on more. This is something that Laura Thomas, PhD, who's an intuitive eating counselor and registered nutritionist, talks about quite a lot. And she says it's a process of addition. So instead of going, I'm not allowed that coping mechanism, you can say, let's add some more coping mechanisms. I'm not allowed that food. Oh, well, actually, I will be metabolically healthier if I eat more fruit and veg. That is true. So positively reinforce those positive behaviours, and you'll feel better in general, regardless of if you're big or small.
Correct. And if you have put weight on, stop trying on your unstretchy clothes for a little while, because you can't lose it overnight.
Don't do body checking. It's really not.
Yeah, it's really quite negative.
Doesn't get you anywhere.
No, it just makes you feel more.
I mean, tired. I think we've responded to these as best we can. I mean, I could do a whole series on this. Maybe I will, because anyone can do whatever they want on Star and Shadow Radio. That'd be good.
It's quite good to talk about food and weight gain in lockdown, though, because I think lots of people are experiencing the same thing. So
yeah,
I think it's quite a common condition.
I'm really interested to hear from anyone else who's got other opinions, and from the people who wrote in themselves. Let's see what they've got to say. I think we should have a little break, don't you, Marion?
And maybe a jingle.
Oh, a jingle. Okay, put the kettle on, put a jingle on. All right. See you in a minute or two.
Fantastic. Super.
And we're back. Have you had a nice coffee, Marion?
Oh, Gilly, do you know, I feel so much more refreshed having had my cup of tea.
Is it just Builders?
Yes, it's always Builders.
With organic whole bean soy milk?
Correct. So the way to go.
I've just got a drink of water. More ideas.
Oh, well. Yeah.
So before we go on to the last two problems, I want to make a big announcement.
Okay? Yeah.
So for the next episode, which will be episode 5 in a fortnight's time, we will have a guest agony aunt. Let's call him an agony aunt. Why not? It's gender neutral. He is a listener, and he's my friend and colleague, Greg Woodhead. He and I have bonded over our love of a different call and advice podcast. This isn't a podcast, this is a radio show, but so Greg and I bonded over that. Greg, I'm sure, will provide great advice for any listener who chooses to write in. So, yeah, write in.
How exciting.
I know.
I can't wait, Gilly.
And isn't Greg just great?
Oh, he's fabulous. Yeah.
Thrilled. But what a treat for us and all the listeners. He's also from Texas. So it's a different kind of voice, not a Geordie woman.
Yeah.
He's a man. And he lives in London, and he's a theatre maker and writer and live artist and all round cool guy.
Yeah, so he's going to bring loads to our problems, and it'll be another perspective and another opinion. So get your problems sent in.
We can't promise anything at gmail.com, but you know that already.
But you do. We can't promise anything, but we can give you loads of opinions. What you take is entirely up to you. Right.
So hit us with the next problem.
Right. So this is problem, and it's, hi, Gilly and Marion. I have a problem. I'm a man in my late 30s. I'm from a conservative religious background, though now I am neither conservative nor religious. My boyfriend and I have been together for multiple years. My problem is that my mother doesn't seem to acknowledge I have a boyfriend unless she has to. She doesn't ask about him and therefore doesn't really know much about him. If asked, she insists she doesn't have an issue with my relationship or the fact I'm with a man. And it's not that I think she has a huge overt problem with it. It's just that it's not comfortable for her that I'm with a man. She doesn't make an effort like she does with my straight siblings partner. And in a subtle way, her behaviour makes me feel more like an outsider in my family and like I have to play both sides. Portray that my relationship is perfect to my mother, and portray that my family is totally on board with the relationship to my partner. When I have tried to discuss the issue with my mother, she has at times cried and said things like, I can't do anything right, can I? She reacts in a way I feel is out of proportion and creates a situation where my concern gets sidelined and I end up reassuring her instead of the other way around. My questions are, what other ways can I broach this with her so that she will actually listen? Or do I have to accept that she is not in a receptive place and I might always feel a little out of place with my own family? I live very far away from my parents, and so any communication is done at a distance. Oh.
That's really tough.
It is.
Have you got any first thing? Is there anything that you think this is what to do?
Well, I think this problem is from someone who's very lovely because they really want to fix something with their mother, right? And I think, you know, something's going to have to change because they're very unhappy and they're concerned about their relationship with their mother. And I think this behaviour has probably... this pattern has probably existed for a while. But also, to say something which I think is very interesting and significant, in that they have to pretend to their mother that their relationship is perfect and to their partner that their family is totally accepting. And I think, you know, I've done that before, kind of told a fib and then become a victim of the fib that I've told because it's got to a point where it's become a fact in the world, and it's the longer time goes on, the more difficult it becomes to change, because it's been too painful to do anything about at the time. It's then you end up stuck with the problem. So really, something has to change, and the person who has to initiate the change is our writer, because they're the person, because they are that person.
That's also the point that really clicked with me, that this guy is having to sort of lie both ways, and not lie, but, you know, maybe present a different reality than is exactly accurate or is exactly their experience. But it made me think that, like, what if you just didn't do that anymore? What if, because no relationships are perfect, familial or romantic. So what if you did just tell your mum, like, oh, I'm really annoyed with Bruce or whatever he's called. And this thing's happened. And what do you think I should do? And if your mum gets uncomfortable, then your mum's uncomfortable. And you can just say, oh, mum, what, you know, like sort of invite her in a bit. I mean, of course, like...
That's a lovely phrase, invite her in a little bit. I thought invite her in a little bit, but maybe a little bit more gently than that, Gilly. So, you know, if the FaceTime, why not have your boyfriend beside you when your FaceTime starts to say, hi, how are you? Just like change the pattern.
Make them a person.
Introduce things a little bit. Make it a little bit more personal. Bring your partner in at the end to say, bye-bye, how are you? It's lovely to speak. Ages since I've seen you. How are you? Right.
Yeah, it's not clear whether they've actually met, is it? Because if they live far away, it's not clear whether the partner and the family have met.
Yes, distance can make you feel removed from the relationship. It's also with a sibling living locally or closer, then you feel like that problem doesn't exist with the sibling, and you're attaching at the distance to you being gay rather than to the sibling just living closer and just physically seeing the parents more often. Mm-mm. You know, and it might just be that your mum feels more awkward getting to know someone from a distance, which is possible.
I mean, it is possible, but it sounds to me that this person is distinctly sort of introspective and has considered this. And
yes, I agree. But I think it wouldn't be so much of a problem if the distance.
Maybe not, but also because it would be like a pattern of what do you call it? When you like have a phobia and you have to like, you know, if you have a phobia of spiders, then you have to touch a plastic spider or something. What's that called?
Yeah. Oh, it's some sort of therapy, isn't it?
Yeah. Exposure therapy. So this is awful. But if your mum had to meet your partner like once a week, because that's when your family met up, after about 6 weeks, your mum would be like, oh, right, you know, actually.
Why did I feel so resistant? Or why did I feel so awkward?
He's just a bloke, you know, he seems nice enough, or I don't like him that much, but it's fine, or.
I think we can make a few suggestions. Would it be possible for you to speak to your, what sort of relationship do you have with your sibling? Could you maybe speak to your sibling about, this is how I feel, right? Or is that too big an ask? Would it be too much to put it all out there, all in one go? Or should you just drip feed? We can't answer that. It's only our writer could answer that.
Yeah.
Because, again, behaviour patterns and habits become entrenched, and then it becomes difficult to break them. And, this kind of fib that's grown up around, well, everything isn't all right, but really I'm pretending it is. It's grown out of love, not out of hostility. It's grown from a very lovely place, but now you're kind of trapped in it.
But I do think there's something important not to pander to the mum, because actually if the writer is correct in his understanding, the mum is homophobic, you know, or at least to a degree. She might not be someone who, you know, is violent or something, but to a degree there is a sort of element of homophobia there. And that does need to stop. It's not that the writer in and their partner need to change anything. The homophobia does need to be eradicated.
I'm talking about the writer more facilitating change rather than, because you can't force anybody to change, but you can open up opportunities to maybe see that maybe homophobic thoughts. I'm sure the mother wouldn't actually put that label on.
Probably not, but, you know, that is how it's manifesting, isn't it?
But so the writer actually asks two questions. What other ways can I broach this with her so she will actually listen? So I'm saying, you know, talk to your sibling, maybe do a two-way attack. Maybe they could say positive things about you and your partner to your mum about how they've been speaking to you, and isn't it lovely that, you know, you're so happy and you're settled in a relationship, and just kind of change the whole aspect of it. You talk to your mum just in little ways if you can't do it all in one go. Maybe, I don't know, little things. Could you write to your mum, send her some photos? You know, think of it, email her with photos of you and your partner out doing great fun things, looking happy together. Look at what this meal that we've cooked, look at this place that we've visited, and talk about us a little bit all the time, instead of not, because then it becomes the thing that everybody doesn't talk about.
I also wonder if mom has a partner, like, is there,
well, yes,
is there, is there, is there a broader context of this, and is it always landing on the mum, because mums are supposed to be endlessly accepting and receptive, when actually, you know, they're just human beings like everyone else. But it is very painful if your parents don't accept something in you. It just really is. And you know, it's just hurts.
Yes, it does hurt. But the second part of the question is, or do I have to accept she's not in a receptive place? And maybe ultimately, I don't know, because you're gonna have to chip away and see what you can do by maybe changing how you communicate with her a little bit, and see if that see if you can create a more positive, and don't be frightened to do, because it's tricky to start and talk in a different way or to change things, and just do it a little bit at a time so you can build up your own confidence. But the second part is, do I have to accept, you might have to accept that she is who she is, right?
Which is also painful. It is also painful.
Well, it is, but you can ease that pain, I think. And do you know, a friend, I once had a very tricky relationship with somebody, and a person who I care about a lot said to me, but marrying the love you as much as they can.
Mm.
And that you're looking for something that they are unable to give.
I think you've given me that advice a lot of times.
Well, only because, you know, pass the good advice on.
It sounds like a Marianism.
Somebody gave that advice to me, I pass it on. But it's a very liberating thing to do. Sometimes you just have to accept, don't be frightened to have a bash to change things for yourself. But sometimes you might get to a point where you have to accept, this is how it is, but this is as much as this person is capable of giving me, which in itself is liberating, because then you can let go of wanting to have more.
Oof, I needed to hear that today.
Oh, shut up.
No, it's great. I hope that's enough for now. Do let us know how you're getting on and what you think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think we'll move on to the last problem, Marion, because we've gone on quite enough.
Do you know, I so try to rein myself in. We can just gossip forever.
You mustn't rein yourself in, Marion. It's marvellous. Mm-hmm. Right, so the next person is called Laura. And she says, Dear Gillian Marion, I'm a newbie to your great show and would appreciate your opinions about something I've discovered about myself during lockdown. With more time on my hands, I decided to tidy my wardrobe, and I'm appalled to discover what a massive spender and consumer I am. I found I have so many clothes, far more than I need, and I'm ashamed to admit some of them are unworn and still have labels attached. Pre-lockdown, I was always in a dash and in the habit of buying stuff that caught my eye with no thought to whether I needed it. Then when I got home, I would squeeze it in my already bursting wardrobe. I am horrified to admit this about myself, and my terror is that when life returns to some sort of normal, I will slip back into old habits. I would appreciate any advice you can offer me to overcome my thoughtless, wasteful spending addiction.
Dun, dun, dun. Do you know, it could almost be me writing this.
I've been there in my life.
Yeah, it's. Do you feel like lockdown, Gilly, has made you look at how much stuff you've got?
Well, I think we all have. Like, I'm on Freegal, right? So this community sort of sharing thing. People are chucking away all sorts. People are clearing themselves out. You see stuff on the streets. I think people have realised, like, hang on a second, I don't actually need loads of this tosh.
I think lots of charity shops are a little bit nervous about reopening.
But they are reopening. So I've got
only because of the avalanche of donations they're expecting to get from everybody's clear out.
I'm interested in thinking, like, what strategies could you put in place, even if they're temporary? So my auntie Sharon, great auntie Sharon, she did a year long thing of, I'm not going to buy anything new, a year.
Right.
And I think that's a really interesting thing to do. It's a bit like with the eating, actually. It's like, how can you provide yourself a bit of space so that you don't, so that things aren't habitual, that you're being intentional about your behaviours? So that's,
do you know,
I
agree, Gilly, and I think there's a link to the eating question and this question. It's about, what am I conditioned to do? Even though I think I'm not, I'm still obviously influenced by, I want to look a certain way.
Yeah.
In the clothes department.
Also a sense of comfort, a sense of like, oh, you know, I get a hit from buying things. I notice it even at the supermarket. Like sometimes I go for a run and I don't really need anything from the shop, but I'll just nip into the shop just to get like a hit of I've bought something. Which is exactly what capitalism wants from us. We want to be rewarded by the satisfaction of pointless desire, of like fabricated desire.
Do you think in lockdown, lots of us have realised that that hit from spending that money is actually a very superficial hit?
Yeah.
And there's no depth to it. And actually, now that I'm at home, I've discovered fantastic things from recontacting with friends who I haven't seen for years in some instances, and the joy of lovely relationships, and just going out for a long walk, in very simple, free things, actually, yeah. That money is not the source of joy.
There's also this thing that you could look it up, but I can't remember what it is now. But I had a friend, it's something like you have a wardrobe of only 30-something garments apart from like pants and bras. And that's all that you're allowed. So if you want to buy another one, you have to get rid of one. And I think that's quite a good challenge. Because you probably buy better stuff. You'll know that you've got fewer options. Like your outfits you're gonna have the same two pairs of trousers or one dress. Yeah. And that's just fine. That is just fine. That's enough clothes.
I think the principle of one out, one in is very good. But if you've got a wardrobe that you don't even know what you've got because it's so absolutely rammed with stuff, you've got to get rid of some of your stuff.
I also have this other thing with charity, putting stuff in the charity bag, which I used to have like a real problem with. And I love going to charity shops. But what because of my love for charity shops, I was able to think, is there another woman or person who wears clothes like this? Is there another person who would enjoy this item more than I'm enjoying it right now? Yes. So if it's in your wardrobe, you're not really getting any pleasure from it.
And neither is anyone else.
So can you give that up to the world and think, yes, some other person would love this much more than I'm into it, or make use of it, or find pleasure in it?
I think that's a very good mantra to have to offload some of your stuff. But this question is, the worry is, what can I do to not go back to mindless spending of unnecessary stuff?
I think have a year off. You clearly don't need any more clothes.
I think have a year off is fantastic. And then the other thing is, if you see something that you really think in a shop that you think, ooh, I would love to buy that, why don't you sleep on it for at least 48 hours.
That's a good one.
Because often that instant gratification thing will disappear, and you might even forget what it was you were looking at in the shop.
Yeah, definitely. I also thought, what if you wrote down how much you spent on clothes?
I think that would probably be a horrifying thing. But maybe, you know, the truth hurts, but maybe you've got to face it.
That's a kind of aversion therapy that you might need to have. Like, actually, this is the true cost. And maybe you could write down all that. And then if you're not willing to give up all your clothes spending for a year, whatever you can spend on clothes, you have to match with charity donations.
Yes. Or I was thinking, why don't you put the money that you would have spent on clothes during lockdown, why even half of it, and make charitable donations and get into the habit of maybe being a bit more generous and giving more.
You could put a tenner in the pot for Star and Shadow and the rest
for
Black Lives Matter related things, or food banks in the area, or campaigning against this fashion.
But there's so many fantastic good causes out there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Locally, nationally, internationally, there's loads to choose from. So you could do some good with something that would have just been an object in your wardrobe.
And the hit of generosity will be so much more powerful and sustaining than the hit of a new frock.
Correct.
I mean, I wish I could lift up to all of this all the time. You
Me
know.
Too. You know, aren't we red hot on the theory, Gilly?
I mean, I've probably bought one, maybe two garments during lockdown.
I can honestly say I've bought nothing.
The toast Not sale, Marion.
I've resisted everything. I have resisted everything because I'm trying to get myself in a frame of mind of, well, what do you need and what do you want?
That's a good thing. That's also another strategy. Do you need this or do you want it?
Yeah. And often you want it because you think it's going to add something to your life. And when it adds nothing, it just takes up more space in your house.
Yeah.
Right. And wouldn't it be lovely if there was like a huge change after lockdown for the good of we started to do things that we need to do rather than just frippery want to do.
And on the issue of clothes, I'm going to get into another rant, but like, you know, the normal high street shops from which you buy clothes are exploitative. They do harm the lives of people in the global south. They do. So maybe to deter yourself, you could look up what say Topshop does, or what H&M does, or what I don't know, M&S does. It's not good. It's really not good. No. So if you're buying clothes and where you're not sure what the policy is of that company, if you're not 100% sure, you are perpetrating violence.
And you maybe you could research ethical.
Yeah, or secondhand.
Spend more, buy less, but buy ethical. If you must buy it all.
I would really like to hear, who knows if we'll still be doing this show in a year, Marion, but if Laura decides to do that, how she's got on? I'd be fascinated. I'd really want to know, Laura, what are you going to do? That's the challenge. You have to write in and tell us what your plan is. We've given you loads of options. You now have to choose.
Well, Gilly, absolutely. Maybe there's a challenge for all of us to think about.
We'll let everyone know next time.
Correct.
And next time we also, of course, have Greg Woolhead listening to all your problems. Maybe he'll bring a problem. Who knows? For us to talk about. Maybe not. Maybe that's a bit exposing. but you'll be a brilliant agony aunt. And take the pressure off us a little bit. So you can send in your problems to wecan'tpromiseanything@gmail.com. And we'll see you in a fortnight.
Excellent. I can't wait. So in the meantime, bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Star and Shadow Radio. Keep it locked.